The reckoning that's tearing through society as we grapple with how our institutions treat Michiganders of color has been especially electric in the nonprofit arts world. Several of Detroit's arts institutions are grappling with public campaigns asking for change. As our summer series on systemic racism continues, we're spending this week talking about how those experiences are lived in some of the museums and gallery spaces in the metro area and beyond. With us today are Tiziana Baldenbro, a curator and writer originally from the L.A. area, and she served as a Ford Curatorial Fellow at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, or MOCAD. Tiziana, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Maceo Keeling is also here. He's a multidisciplinary artist and designer who's worked in several disciplines of contemporary performance. He's also a U.S. Army veteran, and like Tiziana, he was also a Ford Curatorial Fellow at MOCAD. Hi, Maceo.
Hello, how are you doing?
Okay, and also with us, Andrea Montiel de Schumann. She's a digital experience designer who, until recently, worked at Detroit Institute of Arts. On her departure, she wrote a very vivid essay about her experiences and concerns about the museum's management, and she's one of several current and former staffers who've spoken out. Andrea, it's good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Andrea, do you think you could share an example of systemic racism that you've encountered at an arts institution that either you worked at or studied with in some capacity?
Absolutely. I think it's important to note that there's many issues that people will not think that are obvious, but that we that work internally can feel strongly. One particular example that I can remember was as we were preparing a large exhibition for the public, and there was a case of clear cultural appropriation. A Black curator brought up that we were going to be diving into this issue. And then I remember clearly the director stopping him and explaining or just stating that he did not want us to use the words cultural appropriation, because what is cultural appropriation anyways? Nobody in the room was able to respond against or to continue that dialogue. Many of us were scared. And this is not an unusual situation.
Yeah. Maceo, what about you? Is there something you could tell us about?
You know, I have experience with institutions wanting to play up my racial identity or inadvertently or explicitly tie my work to racial, historical, slavery, you know, social justice things without my doing so, creating a context where my work or the work of Black artists is kind of pigeonholed as social justice work, whether or not that's something that I'm actually trying to communicate, and then also aligning it with other artists who are people of color or Black artists, when I might actually be talking about technology. It's somehow like pulled into this sort of rather narrow narrative about what Black art has to be about, whether that's always making it centering or engaging with whiteness or oppression, or aligning it with other artists whose work isn't actually similar in very, very many ways, but we happen to be Black, you know? So that sometimes looks like a Black History Month exhibition where I'm being asked to come in and quote unquote like, do my thing, as if it's not a practice that I've been working on for years or it doesn't take the same amount of rigor as other artists.
Maceo and Tiziana, you were both invited to come and do some work at MOCAD as part of a Ford Foundation fellowship that was intended to specifically address equity issues. The fact that people of color are less often asked to curate at museums and galleries of note. And you're also part of a group of, I want to say, 39 current or former staff and volunteers who have spoken out about conditions there and asked for the resignation of Alicia Barrowy Reeder, the executive director of MOCAD. The fact that you were invited in and were not the only curators of color who ended up leaving MOCAD because of differences with ways that the director was running things. I mean, should people, is there something that people should take away from the fact that this wasn't effective? You can invite curators of color into an institution and still not get the kind of meaningful change that maybe is hoped for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, there were several instances where we felt very tokenized as individuals. It was, of course, it was a diversity program, but there were meetings where, you know, she would introduce us as the Ford Fellows who were brought in to bring the diversity to the curatorial vision, and not because we're incredibly bright individuals who are accomplished or, you know, all of the things that we've achieved. And so it really does sort of become this conversation about like, oh, you were brought on because of the color of your skin or because of your background. And so that is really troubling and disturbing, but also to think about how these systems sort of only insert diversity at the bottom, you know, where you're most easily tokenized or sort of taken for granted, as opposed to sort of at the top, instead of addressing these problems from the point of leadership downward, you know, this kind of infusion at the bottom, it just serves to sort of like perpetuate these systems where the people who are most easily oppressed continue to be oppressed.
We've seen from the experiences of artists who've spoken in response to this that this is clearly not the only time or place this has happened. What is your read on why this keeps happening in contemporary art circles?
Well, one of the things I think is important is recognizing the difference between representation, a numerical count of people of color in a photo, and actual resource distribution and support. You know, I can say that I took the curatorial fellowship and was contractually promised budget to produce a show and do research for that show during the 12-month period of my fellowship, and found out, you know, almost immediately that that wasn't going to be happening, that the budget for that show was not available to me, and that I would have to stay an additional period of time if I wanted to actually curate a show of my own. And that's like an example of, one, a bait and switch, which just contractually is unethical, but also an example of how we're being touted as the, you know, solution, or this is what we should be doing, creating space and opportunity, when that space and opportunity isn't actually available inside the organization, to reaffirm Tiziana's point. And that also happens at the level of the artist, where when it comes time to avail spaces to artists, when it comes time to avail budgets, we continue to invest more resources into artists. This is more structural. We continue to invest more resources into promoting and supporting artists whose names are already rather large, who are already recognized, further increasing the gap of exposure and resource, as opposed to looking at, hey, how can this place be a site to uplift emergent artists and narrow that gap and widen what is possible and who has access to art careers.
Are there ways in which the financial models of arts nonprofits are allowing, you know, the kinds of racism that artists and curators have experienced to continue? Is there something inherent to the way we, you know, the way we govern nonprofits that maybe is part of the problem? Andrea?
I will say absolutely. I think that a good amount of the field of museums is waking up to the reality that the financial systems that museums have put in place are unsustainable at this point. And what I mean by this is that they do not match the general conscious of the culture right now. The majority of people who happen to have power tend to be people who are very, very wealthy within decision-making. So people that are providing large amounts of money definitely drive a lot of the conversation and the decision-making power of an institution.
Andrea, your work has to do with designing the experiences that people have when they walk into museums like DIA. And I think for some people, it may not be intuitive for them if they haven't experienced this themselves. They walk into DIA, they may see a collection that was curated by a person of color. They may see the very prominently located Kehinde Wiley painting that adorns one of the museum's most prominent galleries. And they may not understand quite what we're talking about. How can experiences in the places where we see art, how can we make them more equitable?
One of the important things to have in mind, and I appreciate your thinking on, yes, people are coming into a building and they're seeing a collection, but that's not the only thing that they're experiencing. How people are welcome, how people are addressed, how people are guiding through their experience within a museum matters immensely to the quality of their visit. It's also just the fact that we're not only visual people. Humans take input in our experiences from all of our senses. So even the colors, even how words are positioned, all of this are messages. And oftentimes are messages to define who is welcomed in this institution and who is not. So language can be used as a welcoming tool, and it can also be used as an exclusion tool. I would love to hear also some thoughts from Tiziana and Marcel on this, but I have a strong belief that oftentimes people dismiss the full experience that a museum should and can offer by just thinking, oh, it has a good collection, that should be enough.
How about it, Maceo, Tiziana?
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak to the fact that because we don't have a collection, you know, and I think that that's part of
at MOCAD, it's not a collecting MOCAD institution. Right.
Yeah, and I keep saying we. MOCAD does not have is not a collecting institution, and I think it really has this really unique position in terms of what community-based art institutions should do. You know, I think a lot of people look to MOCAD for a very contemporary art experience that is on the pulse of Detroit's art world, and I think a big part of the problem for us has been making sure that people feel invited and welcome. And when we have, you know, because our leadership was, you know, our director was there and was so prominent, like that was hugely detrimental to our relationships with the community. I would go to art events in the community and just constantly hear stories that people were telling me about their negative experiences. And so our archive is literally the community that we work with. It's the living memory, the institutional memory of the city. And so when you hear these stories and the reluctance that people have to engage with, to work with the museum, it really becomes detrimental to the key relationships and value that the institution has to the city. And it really impacts the way that people view and perceive your role. And so it really was, you know, it's, I agree completely. Language is exclusionary. Design can be exclusionary or inclusive. But for us, it was also just making sure that these relationships that we were putting on the line, felt respected and honored as opposed to sort of just used and abused, which in many cases they did.
Meaning to say the relationships that you had with artists in the community who were trusting you, that if they came to an event that they would feel welcome.
Right. Yeah. And there were so many times when they didn't feel welcome and they knew they weren't welcome. And it was really, you know, it put us in very precarious positions with respect to inviting, you know, people who were our peers in the region to invite them and feel welcome.
Yeah. You know, both the groups, you know, current and former staffers from MOCAD and the folks who have been talking about conditions at DIA have approached the boards of the institutions with a series of things that you say need to happen. And they include but are not by any means limited to the resignations of the existing directors. Have you had any response from the boards in either case?
Not on my end.
it's been very tepid. I know that they have hired a legal team and have asked for outreach. We're still trying to figure out some of the like ways in which MOCAD resistance responds to some of their own questions, mostly because their legal team was hired through one of the board members who works for the firm that they've hired. So obviously there is a huge reluctance on behalf of many of the former employees and current employees to be forthcoming with an independent investigator who is not in fact independent.
Mm-hmm. I will add on my end that we are aware that potentially the DIA has hired a crisis management firm. So this isn't an interesting development, but we have not received a public statement fully addressing, for example, the letter that I released. There have been internal messaging, there have been some vague public messaging, but I don't think enough emphasis on the fact that, yes, this is a widespread complaint. This is the great majority of the staff. And I think that the time will be able to show it. Like Tiziana is mentioning, it is natural that a number of the staff internally have been reluctant to speak up because we are experiencing the middle of a pandemic. People are not feeling super confident talking about structures or institutions as big as the DIA. They feel like their livelihood might be at danger.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Andrea Montiel de Schumann. She's a digital experience designer who worked until recently at Detroit Institute of Arts. We're also speaking with Tiziana Baldenbro and Maceo Keeling. They both spent time as Ford Curatorial Fellows at MOCAD. Guys, some of the problems that we're talking about, the fact that many of our arts institutions rely on patrons and board members and collectors of means who may not be most in touch with disenfranchised communities. This is one of the oldest stories in the art world. What comes to mind when you think about funding models that might encourage more equity within our, you know, these institutions that we all love and that all three of you have said that you do still have very strong feelings for yourselves?
Well, I think that one of the first things we can do is recognize that the problem is built into the way of thinking that it must come from a small number of very wealthy donors, and that is like fundamentally what drives the funding resources. But there is alternate ways of running a museum where you are more focused on education, more focused on experiences. And museums already have multiple revenue streams. You know, there's obviously places that have collections, there's land endowments, there is also increasing the participatory programming and, you know, charging small amounts, pay what you can, and expanding and diversifying other streams of income instead of just saying our museum is going to be, you know, predominantly funded by donors and foundations. Mm-hmm. And so we can rely less on those huge checks. And then that diversifies who has authority and who has say.
And I will add to that it is interesting that the DIA will be a particular case here, right? Because part of the funding of the institution is public, is through a millage. I think that for something like this, it is important that an institution can show the value of this contribution. So I do think it is critical to also highlight how an institution is planning on honoring that pact in which so many constituents are giving taxes. So demonstrating not just through community outreach, but how they are working through internal systems, how they are setting people of color in environments where they're going to be successful, how we're planning on reaching communities in meaningful and sustainable ways. All of these matters are important.
But ultimately also these are nonprofit institutions who receive benefit through not having to pay taxes in certain ways. And so there is a lot of ownership that the city can take, that the city residents can take in terms of what they feel they have access to. We have over 320 signatures on a community artist list of support for our actions. And so I really do think that there is a vested interest in seeing these cultural spaces thrive and respond to the pulse of the city. And so how do we make space for that kind of stewardship?
Are you optimistic that other organizations are aware that they've been put on notice because of the work that these two groups and others have done?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not just our groups. We were hugely influenced by the Detroit Will Breathe movement, who is out there on the streets day after day, putting their lives at risk and really facing up to the public debate in ways that are super impressive and really admirable. And what they're trying to do is actually normalize these kinds of conversations and confrontations. The work of making equitable spaces is not going to be easy. It's not ever going to be comfortable, and it's always going to involve some risk taking, and it's always going to involve, you know, some hurt individuals who are unwilling to release some of their power and agency. And so it's going to be a struggle, but I do think that it's happening, and this is the moment to really address it in every environment where we see racial inequities and injustice being held.
Tiziana Baldenbro is a curator and writer, formerly a Ford Curatorial Fellow at the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit. We've also been speaking with Maceo Keeling, multidisciplinary artist and curator, and also a former Ford Fellow at MOCAD, and with Andrea Montiel de Schumann, who's a digital experience designer of late employed by Detroit Institute of Arts. I want to thank all three of you so much for everything that you've been willing to say publicly on this subject and for talking to us about it today.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Much appreciated.
I should say also, we've made numerous requests for comment from both the DIA and MOCAD, and to date, neither has been willing to come on the show.